Okay, so during 2018 and 2019, you ran a marathon in every single country of the world, which totaled 196 countries. And yeah, by doing this, you became the first person to ever achieve this feat. I want to ask, first of all, what do you think the fact that you achieved this says about who you are?
Well, firstly, thanks for having me on, and I'm keen to get into some of the details with you. What does it say about me running around the world? I think there's a few pros and cons there. You have to be a bit selfish. I think, let's face that, there's a lot of people that help make that trip happen. A lot of stress and anxiety from family. There's a lot of effort in finding funding. And also I think it says I want to travel. I'm maybe have the audacity to try something like that. I think that says something a little bit about me. And naivety. That's the hat trick, I think. A little bit of selfishness, a little bit of naivety, and a little bit of audacity. That probably sums it up about right.
Can you say a bit about what inspires you to take on this feat?
So this goes back to a race in the Sahara, in the middle of the desert. Wonderful race that many, many people may know of, Marathon du Sahara, which is a 7-day race through the desert, about 280 kilometers. You do marathon on day one, marathon on day two, marathon on a double marathon on day three. Just throw that in there. Day off on day four, then marathon, and finish. At the time, this was many years ago, I was trained well. I was sponsored to be there, but I was also edging my way out of a corporate life, if you like. And running had slowly started to overtake my normal career in finance. And this race was a big turning point because I met somebody called Kevin. Kev was this wonderful human who was 49 at the time, and he was diagnosed with terminal prostate cancer. And you spend this race with about eight people in a tent, and there's lots of tents. There's about 1,000 people that take part, and your tent mates are strangers. By the end of the race, they're not strangers. And Kev was one of these strangers that's now become a friend. And he told me he was dying, terminally ill, might not get to see his boy turn 11. And it was really a moment of realization that I'm chatting with this guy who's not long for this world. And he said to me, "What would you do if you could do anything?" And I kind of thought I was already living the dreams, but that's not always the case. And I had a thought that actually he's right. I'm kind of embarrassed not to be able to answer that question. What would I do? One thing led to another, and a few weeks after the race, I was sat in his kitchen with his family having a dinner, and I said, "This is what I'm going to do." And I sat my family down and said, "I'm going to run a marathon in every country in the world, raise some money for Kev, for other people in his situation, and hopefully live by his counsel, which is to not hang around and just do what you love before it's too late." And here we are.
I learned about this successful attempt when my uncle Dave, who's actually always been very much into running athletics, bought me your amazing book, Running the World, for Christmas. I mean, there's a lot to summarize here. You obviously have a little section on 196 sections at least, where you talk a little bit about each country you visited. Are you able to even attempt to maybe in a couple of minutes summarize a bit about the whole challenge? I don't know exactly what you want to draw upon, maybe some of the most exciting moments or countries you went to or something, but yeah, could you kind of talk us through that journey?
If I can summarize the whole trip in a couple of minutes, I think the key word that stands out is people. When you embark on a travels, whether it's gap year backpacking, or whether it's a honeymoon, or whether it's just a weekend break, there will be stories that you tell afterwards that involve people that you meet on a plane. Funny things, silly things, sad things, whatever they be, but people are at the center of most stories, and this is essentially an amplified version of the same concept. Every country in the world, every culture, all the languages, being extremely tired in the process, and having that emotional element thrown in there as well, and of course lots of safety and logistical volatility with certain political situations within countries. They all happened. I think people and kindness were the overarching messages. You meet people are internally kind. I ran with thousands and thousands of people, 9 presidents. I was running with 1,000 kids around El Salvador, ran around the erupting volcanoes in Guatemala. And I was welcomed into homes by, I think, nearly 80 families. It was about 60 families, I think it was, that some of them I didn't speak their language. And they would say, you know, come into my home and I want to help you for your couple of days that you're here, and on you go again. So I just came away with this phenomenal perspective of kindness and humanity.
So I want to ask a bit about some of the other lessons you've learned. You talked about what you learned about people. What did you learn about yourself?
I learned that actually I'm not that afraid of the usual things that other people are afraid of, I think. I kind of, you know, I was very shy as a child, and I thought when I went into this trip, you know, that I was no longer shy anymore. That was when I was a young boy. And now I went into the trip not really knowing if being on your own for a couple of years traveling around the world, you would somehow regress to that little bit element of fear and unknown. But I learned I was okay in those situations. And I also learned that I really wanted it, which I don't think you really know until you embark on something. You know, the whole stories of people running marathons and training. Oh yeah, I'm going to run a London Marathon next year and I'm going to train for it and I'm going to do really well. And some people will train. Most people will get quite close to the event and then try and train. And so I think it taught me that from day one, there was no way that I was going to be finishing that trip without ticking off every country. And we went into it under budget. We went into it having no idea of the true budget, but believing that we could do it for the 100 grand. We then ended up spending circa $1 million and way over budget in every possible angle. There was, you know, 3 times as many flights as we thought we needed, 3 times as many passports as we thought we needed, you know, filling up 9 passports and 455 flights, cancelled airlines, everything went wrong, and yet I still wanted it. It really taught me how if you put your mind to something that you truly love and want to succeed, it will. You just have to kind of grin and bear it. And that was a 4-year journey. It was 2 years on the road, but 2 years worth of planning. And then I lived every second of it. What else did I learn about myself? I pigeonholed certain countries into a certain way. You know, one country might be, let's say Syria. If I say Syria to you, it gives you connotations of certain things. If I say Bahamas or Barbados, it also gives you expectations. And actually, I learned that I did that all through the media, stuff I'd see on TV. But when you see it yourself, it's different. Nearly 9 times out of 10, it's not as you expect. So I learned that as well. Yeah.
I want to ask a little bit more about, in your head, like the kind of psychological experience of doing this. So how much of the venture was enjoyment? How much was suffering and pain? How much was feeling super inspired and up to continue? How much were there ever any moments of thinking, you know, maybe I regret this, I shouldn't have started, I don't know if you went there, but yeah, can you talk us through some kind of the headspaces you went through?
I think there was a general anxiety of not knowing whether you're going to finish the trip. I think that was the underlying, if you talk about main emotions, that's the underlying emotion. It's just like if I say to you, balance an egg on a spoon for a day. The closer you get to the end of that day, the more anxious you're going to get that it falls because you've invested more and more and more. That's a silly analogy, I know, but it is exactly how I felt with the trip. Is the more countries you tick off, the more you invest, the further you are down the line. Yes, it's exciting that you're nearing the finish, but it's also you've invested so much. You know, I couldn't finish that trip and say to myself, I've run a marathon in every country apart from a couple. That just doesn't do it for me. It has to be all or nothing, or very all or nothing. So that was one big high level emotion. The others are elation, having got in and out of some countries that are difficult to get in and out of, whether it be because of safety or because of visas. You know, we're refused visas. And so getting in and out, having had the visas finally approved, was quite a challenge. And then also there's some sadness to leave places and people behind. If I've been hosted for a while with people, you then get to know them. I stayed with a wonderful French family in Dubai, and they hosted me, they supported me so well. I got to know them really well and I'd left. And then 2 days later, I'm involved in another family that's treating me really well and hosting me and taking me to dinner and organizing meetings with like the ministers of sport or the government or whatever. And then it happens again. So there was this fleeting kind of community that just came and went. And so there was a sense of loss the whole time. And then, of course, being scared for your life, which exists when you travel the world, going in and out of places like Yemen or Syria, having things happen that I was hit by cars, I was attacked by dogs, minor heart attack. I had situations that are scary. So there was definitely some fear in there as well.
I mean, this feels like there's two kind of things feel amazing to me about doing this as a personal experience. And it's running this many marathons. It's also just visiting all of these countries. Does one of them, do you kind of divide it up in that way at all in your head? And does one of them feel more of a special thing to you that you traveled the world or that you did this challenge? Can you separate those? Are they intertwined?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the way that I look at that is I'm proud of visiting every country. The running was my vehicle to see and absorb the country. If I say to you or to any people, you know, if you go on holiday for a week anywhere, the likelihood of you being on your feet for 42K, 26 miles in that week is unlikely. You'll either be in a taxi or you'll, you know, stroll around a city for a while or sit by a cafe. But actually absorbing the community that you're in, you land in, let's say, the Congo, and then within hours, you're out running a marathon. And taking in, okay, are people smiling at me? Are the roads tarmac? Are there traffic lights? Are there loud noises? Is there lots of nature? Is it humid? There's literally countless little elements that you absorb into your understanding of the world. And so I think your question is, do I see them? I think I'm not necessarily overly proud of the running element because I know I can run. Don't get me wrong, there were some really hard old runs in there. But the visiting the places and absorbing the places happened in a better way because of the running. So they're intertwined. I don't think you can take them apart.
Is there like another challenge you could think that is kind of more grand than this and being, you know, so amazing? Is there anything on par of just visiting every country?
The thing about visiting every country is that you realize how much of the world you haven't seen. And that is the most profound feeling when you finish a trip like this. You know, if I say to you, oh, have you been to Thailand? And you go, yeah, I've been to Thailand. You know, you can't, even if you had a 10 lifetimes, 100 lifetimes, you can't go to everywhere in Thailand. You can't go down every street. You can't go to every cafe. You can't meet every person. And so let's use China as an example. Absolutely huge. And there's no chance that I'll even touch the surface on the little micro communities and cultures within that one country. And so you finish the trip and people are like, oh, well, what now? Because you've done everywhere. I haven't. I've done every country, but there are so many other places within those countries. So for me now, it's about going back and revisiting the places that I enjoyed and learning about them a bit more and actually visiting the places that I didn't enjoy and seeing if I can change my perspective on them. To your larger question about what next, there are many things in the pipeline, and one that has been brewing for a couple of years now that is close to being started. It's all a case of funding, really, which is to try and break the record for the most consecutive marathons. And the concept here is, rather than just beating it, which is, I believe it's in a couple of hundreds is the official record, which I've kind of already done to in an unofficial capacity. But I am going to go and run 1,000 marathons in 1,000 days. And it's not been advertised at all yet. We've not really spoken about it because it's as yet hasn't got a start date. But that trip is 3 years, you know, 3 years of back-to-backs. It will be all-encompassing and it poses a different challenge to me. Yes, okay, running a marathon every day is difficult. I mean, I've done it since. I've done doubles for 100 days since running around Britain. I've done things like that. But the challenge with 1,000 days is, if you look at the word resilience and consistency and discipline, no matter what happens in my life for 3 years, I've got to run for probably 4 or 5 hours every day. And so that's going to happen. It will be all over the world. We have two plans. One will be the Pan American Highway, so from Alaska down to Chile, which is, coincidentally, if you zigzag a bit, roughly 26,000 miles. So that's helpful. Or depending on what happens in my personal life with family, with, if I have children, what happens with my parents who are getting older, it may turn into a hot, in like I just mentioned, go to revisit all those places that I love and spend a month, do 30 marathons, hop to somewhere else. So it's planned both ways. The funding's been approached for a couple of years. We have many, many whiteboards full of plans, and I'm absolutely so ready to do that trip. But it is also terrifying. So we'll see.
And any idea when this, as soon as you may start this, maybe?
2027. Yeah, that's the start date, and weather and location will dictate exactly when in the year that will happen.
Okay, great. Whilst we're kind of talking about this, and especially for 1,000 days, I do just want to stay for a second and ask about a couple of technicalities. And I know a lot of people close to me, I'm sure people watching, who are, you know, runners, marathon runners themselves. Could you just briefly tell us a bit about, you know, how you fuel for races, how you avoid injury, how you think about pace when you're running, some of these kind of more technical, geeky questions for the run enthusiasts?
Yeah, the geeky questions for the runners. I think my approach is somewhat skewed. And I think when I get asked these questions about, you know, like you say, the geeky questions of pace and et cetera, et cetera. I've done what now, 1,065 marathons. So I've done a fair few. I'm up to nearly approaching that 100,000 mile mark in my legs, in my life. So it's very difficult to answer those questions with perspective, with the correct answer. So if I talk about pacing or training or nutrition for a marathon, if you are somebody that's training for a race, whether it be ultra, half marathon or marathon, the key things I think are important are, number one is consistency, and number two is understanding why you're doing something. You know, are you entering the London Marathon because everybody else is and your mates talked you into it? Are you doing it to raise money for charity? Are you doing it because you want to give it a go? Are you doing it because you want to finish and post that on Strava to say you've got a quick time? I think the fact is, be honest with yourself of why you're doing it. I have this philosophy, if you like, that there is a cycle of you start running because you either want to be fit or because somebody talks you into it, you want to lose a bit of weight perhaps. You then go, oh, there's a race over there, my mate I'm training with or I ran with a few times says come and do that race. You do that race, you think, oh, that's quite fun, so I'll do another race. And then you do a few more, you maybe the distance increases, collect a few medals, starts to become, and then you start calling yourself a runner. And then things start to spiral, and you get the watch and you get everything else. And then there's this kind of, there's a bell curve. You're in the dip then almost of, okay, I've done a lot of running. Now what? And then you either go to improve your time or you run further. But I think once you've got through that process, you're out the other side, there is just beauty in the simplicity of running, being able to have, you know, I run every day at 6:30 in the morning, and I have that little bit of peace in my day where I can start, you know, there's this whole phrase of move the body before you move the mind, which I completely agree with. I think it's such a great way. And so if I can answer that question in one sentence, is don't overthink things. Just put your shoes on, get out the door and think about why, you know, why are you getting out and training in the rain? Is that because you want to do it for yourself? How are you doing it? Are you actually putting that quality in? I suppose that's the only tip that I think would be useful for everybody, any runners listening, is that if you're training for anything, balance the quantity with the quality. If you're, you know, there's no point boasting about your 100-mile week if those 100 miles have essentially been half walking and really slow or too quick to the point that you've injured yourself. You know, you have to have that balance between quantity and quality. I met a guy years ago who became a friend, a guy called Rob, who was in his 50s at the time. He was a 2:14 marathoner. He was a quick guy back in his day, and he was with the GB team. And he said to me, "If you're going to do this, this was a long time ago. If you're going to do this running thing, don't forget the quality miles. You've got to have quality miles in you." And so every week, if I get to a Sunday and I haven't done some quality miles, I have to go out and do some. And it's pretty much because that phrase was told to me. So yeah, that's my 2 pence on geeky training stuff.
Great. All right, well, thanks for the advice. So we could just kind of step away now from the kind of the ground challenge you did and go a little bit more into your kind of story, your journey and who you are. So I believe you were born in Dorset. Could you kind of run us through your story a little bit, your life until maybe you did this challenge, touching upon, you know, anything in your life that you think is worth sharing that would kind of help us understand who you are and your journey to where you are now?
Yes, in Dorset, near the coast, kind of middle of nowhere, kind of countryside, but not too far from the ocean. I grew up I couldn't really walk properly when I was very young. I had feet that were almost 90 degrees in, and there was lots of talk about operations when I was a kid, which ultimately didn't happen, and my legs somehow sorted themselves out. But if anybody's skied before, you'll know that having your feet turned in is quite a good way to do a snow plow and therefore stop when you are skiing. And as I was very young, I was on skis when I was 16 months old, and that was my first introduction to sport and to adventure and to kind of extreme. Not that I knew it then, of course, but that then kind of got me a little bit addicted to that. I was a shy, dyslexic kid at school, struggled to read and write my own name until I was far too old. And I just buried myself in sport. I just loved sport because it was a really great outlet. I was always the one that would be okay at any sport. And so sport happened. I then joined the under 19s Snow Sports England ski team and then went on to do the GB ski team as a junior. And that was when I think everything started to ramp up and realized that sport could be a career path. But as a British skier, it's a little challenging because you're skiing against more or less every other nation that has a load of snow and mountains, and we don't really have that. So I persevered, but I did also have the voice on my shoulders of my parents saying that you should probably get a real job at some point because you can't just be a ski bum. And I as you can imagine, I tried to resist that, but I did eventually get a job and I managed to get some good qualifications in the end. I almost felt like I grew out of my dyslexia and reading, writing, and I did quite well academically in the end. And I got a job in finance, in banking, and I was sucked into this almost instantly. I was sucked into this a horrible career, not horrible, that's harsh, entrapping career of money and things and seeing people around you. And I bought my first house a few weeks before I turned 20, and I had money. I had car, I had mortgage and everything. And I thought, this is quite good. And you get into it and you get a better job. And I worked all over the world and worked hard. And you then realize the car and the stuff doesn't really matter. And I needed a little bit of time to myself. And so I would start to run. I ran kind of to work every now and then. I cycled to work. I then started to run at lunch breaks and any time I could get. Then I started to take the piss a bit with lunch breaks and take a little bit more time in the gym or running. And then I started to enter a few races. And then at some point or another, I had a message from Red Bull offering an opportunity to go and run with them in the Caribbean. And it was this, hang on a minute, do I want to go and run with Red Bull in the Caribbean as part of this series and be sponsored to do so? Yes. But hang on a minute, I can't do that because that's not a proper job and I've got a mortgage and I'm an adult now. You know, when you're in your early 20s, you think that's, you're trying to keep one eye on being sensible while you also don't really want to be. And so I thought, no, I can't do that. Let's carry on working. And then one thing led to another and several, probably about 18 months later, I was racing in more events, and I just invested more and more time into my training, and I was racing in the Ultra Trail World Tour at that time. I kind of grabbed a few little sponsors on the side. I was working less, and then I stumbled across Kev in the Marathon des Sables in the desert, and then I got back, planned the trip, left my job, and now we're skip ahead and 11 world records, and I've not really looked back. So it feels like a bit of like a blur, to be honest. So yeah, running was started almost as a byproduct of finance, which is a bizarre thing to say, but that's how it started. It was the therapy, it was the antidote to finance.
You know, some people would use it as a bit of a break from their job and so on, but can you think at all, like, why you got, you know, so kind of into it as opposed to just, you know, a little bit of a hobby?
I think the truth is two things. One is the feeling like I wanted to have, and you know, if we all say, oh, why do you do long distance running? I think if we're all truthful with ourselves and if we've all had enough therapy, we will probably understand that there's something there that is about validation, which is about having the people around us that mean the most to be proud of us. And although my parents were wonderful, I think subconsciously there's something in there. You know, you have siblings rivalry, you have my brothers are very successful and works in the hospital. And I think there was, unbeknownst to me at the time, it was subconscious of, can I better myself? Can I up one on him maybe? I don't know. I truthfully don't know. The other angle of it is that it was very clearly better for me health-wise. I was a better person. I was less short-tempered. I was less grumpy. I was everything about my general being, you know, being outside more. I didn't want to sit inside in a glass box and make rich people richer anymore. I wanted to do more with my time. And that comes right back to the message from Kev. And I just flipped a switch, and it was, I am going to squeeze every last ounce of life out of me now, because I truthfully don't know if I'm going to live for 10 years or 3 days, and we don't. And I preach a lot about it now, and I'm proud to. I try not to sound preachy, but it does get to that point where I'm basically just want to shake people and say, why are you doing that job if you're moaning about it all the time, which I was. Do something else. You can change it. You still have that within your power. And we live in this world where we're the rich ones, whether it be money or in life and experiences of the whole world. We're in that top tiny percentage of people that have the opportunity to pretty much do what we want, and yet we follow these social norms. And so I just everything changed, almost personality changed almost overnight, where I said, no, I'm just gonna live my life my way, and that is running now. And I couldn't be more happy. You couldn't pay me any money in the world to go back to a conventional job, because it just wouldn't make me happy.
I've heard, I believe you say at one point that you kind of, you love the suffering, you love being in, you know, a really difficult challenge. How do you understand what this word suffering means, and why would you say that you enjoy it? How do you kind of explain that to someone? Obviously, it may seem counterintuitive the first time you hear that.
So I think it's the, not to, what's the word? It's for the privilege of suffering. It's not to suffer, it's for the privilege of it, if that makes sense. So many people in the world, most people in the world, don't have a choice as to whether or not they suffer. We do. And I think there's something within all of us in the developed world which has this unlock, kind of a box that's left untouched. We don't know what it's like to wake up and not have something in the fridge, or not be able to pick up our phone and call whoever we like. I mean, I could list thousands of things there that we just take for granted every day. So I think there's something within us that strives for that. And so when I'm running now, and if it's difficult, I remind myself that it is an option, and it is a privilege to be able to do this for all the people that can't even dream of leaving their own country, to praying to their own God, to having enough food to feed their family, to expect that to have your sisters and your brothers live to old age. You know, all these basic things that we just assume and we fumble through. And so when I'm suffering and I'm in the hurt locker on a long run and broken bones and things go wrong, I remind myself that it's just running, and that's okay. And it's all highly relative to everything else that's going on in the world. So it's a tiny, tiny way of experiencing some suffering when I think it's trying to understand the rest of the world, to be honest.
Another thing kind of saying this kind of area I want to ask about is, you know, you talked a bit ago about how we're talking about how, like, I was asking you why you think you got so into running. There's obviously discussion these days around, you know, words are thrown around like addiction. Maybe someone would say, you know, Nick, he's addicted to running. Like, what would you say to that? What do you think about that word addiction means?
Yeah, and I think actually, if we look at probably the definition of addiction, I'm unsure whether it's classified as an addiction. If you classify it as you crave it, want it, feel like you might need it to be okay, then I think then yes, I can't not check that box. But if I, you know, let's say you hooked me up to a lie detector and said, Nick, are you addicted to running? I think the answer is, am I actually addicted to the running, or am I looking for what that does? You know, so let's say whether it's a class A drug or a bar of chocolate or running, addictions, they can be very different. But the thing with running is that it's not a negative thing, it's a positive thing. So it's very easy to be okay with being obsessed, addicted, passionate about, whatever word you want to use. And so I think we don't properly recognize, lots of us are craving running. I would say it's a craving and a passion. I mean, the addiction thing, having read books like the Matthew Perry's book, where is very heavy on pure addiction that generates such turmoil in his life, this is the opposite effect. It's almost the antidote of addiction, if that makes sense, because you're generating so much goodness from it. I was chatting this morning about addiction on my morning run club, which we all chat to each other virtually. People join me from all over the world, 6:30 every day, and we have a little chat. And actually, addiction in running was talked about, coincidentally. And I said the same thing. I truthfully don't know whether I'm addicted. I get up in the morning and need to go for a run because I'm a better person for it. If I don't run for 10 days or for 3 months, I will probably go a bit mad. But it's not because I'm not putting my shoes on. It's because I'm not getting out there and not letting my mind have that peaceful moment. It's like, imagine your house is really messy and going out for a run tidies that up. That is what my mind is doing. I'm just neater. I know what I'm doing in the day. I feel happy with myself and I'm a better person. So it's an addiction of sorts. It's a good topic. Maybe I'll write an article about is it an addiction or is it an obsession? I'm not sure.
Yeah, relatedly, do you think there's anything that you think people often maybe kind of misunderstand about you? Perhaps people who don't run, people who want to analyze and think about words like addictions or so on. Is there anything like a theme you've ever found about maybe news reporters or so on, like misunderstanding about maybe the way you think and what your life is like?
Great question. And yes, there is the assumption that I'm this often referred to as machine or superhuman, or I'm just like everybody else. I just do running a bit more. That's it. I'm no more capable than anybody, any single person that's listening to this. I'm no more capable running wise. I'm not a better runner. I am really truly. And you think, well, how can that be the case? You've done so much. Yes, I'm more experienced, perhaps, but I am not naturally. I've got a report card from my first school headmaster, and the words are, Nick is not a natural runner. He was also like my PE teacher. And so we're all born equal in that term. And then I've just done it more. I think it is a little frustrating sometimes for me when I do hear the, well, you're a machine, you do so much, you, and I've got all the same limbs. I'm just trotting along. I'm not going at this running thing as in a big extreme sport. I just like to challenge myself in ways. And 99% of my life is going out for a 4K jog with the dog and coming home. You know, that's just like anybody else will. Just every so often, I pop my head up and do a crazy challenge that is running related. Other than that, I'm the same as everyone else.
I want to talk about just briefly a couple of the other kind of highlights, I guess, that it feels like you've done. So what is it? You ran Britain. I said on your website, you did 200 marathons in 128 days, which was the fastest circumnavigation of Britain. You also did the Italian Grand Tour, 100 days, 100 marathons, north to south of Italy. Do these stand out, do you think, as your two other main things you look back on with success, like around the world?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, the world, they're all very different, but they're all challenges that span many months and are heavily running related. So yeah, there's, I think Italy was immediately after the world, well, relatively speaking. And that was between the two lockdown moments and 100 marathons in 100 days. I've not done consecutive marathons like that before. I think up to that point, I've done 30 or 40 days back to back, but I'd never done 100. Certainly not on the road, living in a van with a dog, traveling through Italy. And again, it was, I travel around the world. Where do I want to see again more? I know. I'll do Italy. Austrian border all the way down to southern Sicily, touch the water, job done, 100 marathons. Was a challenge. Lots went wrong. Very different trip. And then coming out of that, COVID kind of phase two happened, and I had this, you just talked about, is it an addiction? I had this fidgetiness to do something. And then Britain was unlocked on the 17th of April. And in the preceding weeks, we basically bodged together a plan to try and break the record to run around the country. And I thought, well, let's try 100 days of double marathons. I had a few injuries during that trip, and so it turned into a month longer than we expected, 28 days longer. But it was averaging between 40 and 55 miles a day. And so if you think about doing 200 marathons-ish in 4 months versus doing every country, that is 196 marathons in 2 years. So the actual, in terms of the physical challenge, running between 350 and 400 miles a week was tough, and probably one of the hardest things it is the hardest thing I've ever done physically, because 12 hours of running a day, you get about 40 minutes to yourself where you can eat. Other than that, you're sleeping or running. So it was very intense. But yeah, running Britain was tough.
And you also founded a foundation called the 196 Foundation. Can you tell us about that?
Thank you for mentioning that. The 196 Foundation, I love, and I'm so pleased that we got it off the ground. It's actually quite challenging to start a charity because there's all sorts of loopholes you have to go through. But finishing the world trip, I came back and I wanted to do something to help causes all over the world where people just needed a bit of a leg up. There was a mum in a hospital that had her two children were very ill, seriously ill, and dying in Sierra Leone. And I visited them. We had a little interview because we were filming for a documentary as part of this bigger trip. And she said, yeah, through a translator, we worked out that she had 9 children, and 7 of those children had died already. And she had these last 2 kids, and essentially she just needed some money to for medicine. She needed some medicine. She needed to... And it was so profoundly like, hang on a minute. And we worked out what it would be to find this medicine, to put them in school and to give them clothes for a year. And it was something like 40 quid. It's ridiculous, ridiculously low, just unfathomable. And the answer, as anybody that's traveled a lot knows, the answer isn't just to give money. It is to do something bigger. And I didn't want to create another charity that was just another charity. I wanted to create a grant foundation that could support other charities that already exist. And so the concept of the foundation is I ask for donations of £1.96 a month, the significance being 196, 196 countries. And every month you donate, so if you wanted to donate, you put the £1.96 in a pot every month. And then we create that over the year, collate it over the year. And every year we put an option to the donors for them to democratically choose who we go and support. It could be, you could email me and say, Nick, I've got this next door neighbor of mine that is in a wheelchair and his wheelchair is broken. He needs a new wheelchair, for example. And we would be able to put some money towards that. But over these last few years, we've turned 41 acres of empty land in Kenya into a farm that's profited tens of thousands of dollars and has employed people and has supported children in schools with the food. We've developed a machine that gives that creates affordable sanitary products to girls in Nepal. We've just done a mental health project year with a charity called Big Moose, and our vote is coming up next month, actually, for this year. So I'm so passionate about it because it's just such an easy win. You put less than 24 quid a year per person into a pot, times by many, many people. We can go and do and deliver a very high value product, that project that supports causes all over the world. And importantly, not just one cause, it's multiple causes.
Are there any causes that are like especially close to your heart?
I mean, I think the mental health causes are really close to my heart. I think we're all on a sliding scale with mental health all the time. And some of us, fortunately or unfortunately, are either end of that spectrum at one point in our life. I've certainly suffered with depression and with anxiety. And I think we all do at certain points in our life. And so mental health charities are so needed. And actually, the funding goes a very long way. The other side of the coin is there are a lot of other people out there that for 40 quid, like I just explained, can change their life so very easily. So, yeah, I think there isn't one cause that it's more the general humanity that I'd like to be able to, you know, when I'm old and grey, I'd like to be able to say I've made a bit of an impact.
Fantastic. Okay, we'll put a link to that below the show in the description as well. Final two questions. You also run these kind of, all right, like away kind of trips, weekends, retreats for people. Can you share a bit about that and what you do?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, this is now my day-to-day life, besides from my expeditions and a few speaking and book writing bits. This is my day-to-day. Run Weekends is the company that we started a few years ago. It hosts trail running holidays, retreats, whatever you want to call it. It's a number of days away, small groups going for a jog. You know, whether it's in the mountains in Dolomites and we're hopping from hut to hut, whether it's five-star accommodation in Dubai, or it could be a private chef in a villa in Spain, or it could be hopping from yurt to yurt in Mongolia. You know, we've got, next year we have 28 trips. The year after that, we've scheduled 36 trips. I'm just looking at the calendar here. We've got Iceland, we have the Lake District, French Alps, Uganda, Barcelona, Dubai, Patagonia, Sri Lanka, like some really great places. And the big thing about this business is that it's A, affordable. We keep margins tiny, and it's for everybody. It's all inclusive. So if somebody wants to come along that is a new runner and they may not do all of the distance, then we cater for it. Most of our trips, you can hop in a van or you can get a lift to the next point and carry on. So there isn't any fear about pace. We just take our time. Have lovely food, take lots of photos, and hopefully stay in touch. And many of our runners, our guests that have been on our trips have stayed in touch and gone on their own holidays as well. So it's brilliant.
That sounds fantastic. Okay, so final question, Nick. I always ask everyone the same question to finish the show, which is, yeah, what do you think it means to live a good life?
I think there are two very key things that I, again, I'm a big believer in. One is around time and one is about kindness. And time being this thing that none of us can change. You know, we are, no matter if you're rich or poor, black or white, whatever it is, everybody exists in the same time. The other thing is kindness, and these are linked. So you can spend your time doing whatever you want, or you can invest it. And in my opinion, the investing element is, essentially, as it sounds, is it reaps rewards that are greater than yourself that will live on past you. So we are all capable of doing our little bit to help the planet. You know, we're talking about environmental. In terms of living a good life, I want to get to my deathbed and know that I've left it better than I found it. And I think if you use your time wisely, you don't just spend it, but you invest it, and then use this multiplier of kindness, and make sure that every week or every day that goes by, you're doing something good for the people and the planet. You know, are you walking past a bit of litter on the street when the bin's right in front of you, you could just pick it up and put it in the bin. You know, little things that multiply that time you're spending. You could use that time to walk straight past that bit of litter, or you could pick it up and put it in the bin, and it would make the world just that little bit better. And if we all did that, then I think that is the way to lead a good life. It's not about things. It's not about success. It's not about anything. It's about love or anything like that. I think it's just about being that little bit of good every time you can. And it's not always easy because we're humans and we experience ups and downs of emotions and hormones and real life. But to lead a good life is just to take those tiny little opportunities to be good and to be kind, to be patient when maybe you don't feel like doing so.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really inspiring to read some of this book and to hear about all the things you've done, especially around the world. And good luck, you know, for sure, this 1,000-day challenge. Look forward to hopefully seeing that on the news and hearing about that in 2027 or whenever it starts. But yeah, thanks for your time. It's been great.
No, thanks for having me on. And again, it's a reminder to you that it's great to have the platform to speak. It's very easy to take that for granted as well. So thank you, Joe. Yeah, really, really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed today's interview. If you did, please support the channel by hitting the subscribe button below. See you next time.